This is The Network Break, a podcast on the state of the business in networking. We discuss vendor moves and news, products and ploys, and we provide analysis on products and positioning and look at the business of networking in about the time it takes to have a coffee break. I'm Drew Connery Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
Back from Interoper New York, and
yes,
un-jet-lagged, and glad to have my presentations behind me. I always get, because I was lucky enough to be a speaker there.
Yes.
On a couple of sessions, and enjoyed the opportunities, but it's always nervous. You never know, and especially when one of my sessions was on the software-defined WAN, which is not conventional, shall we say.
Yes, it's new stuff.
It's new stuff, and you're trying to paint a picture of the far future, you know, in a galaxy far, far away, and sometimes you just get ahead of your audience, and you're going like, maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Well, as a matter of fact, we do have official results, which I will share with you privately off the air.
All right.
But you can rest assured that it was pretty good.
All right. Good enough. So, hey, yay me. It went well then.
It went well.
The metrics are in.
The metrics are in. We'll have you back.
Okay. How about yourself? How was your new Interop? Because that's your primary thing, isn't it?
That is my day job, yes. I thought it was a good show. I'm one of the folks responsible for bringing in speakers and creating sessions and workshops, so I really worry about what folks are getting out of it. And looking at the survey results, it seems like we are satisfying folks' needs. I think there's always more we can do, and we're going to try to make it bigger and better for Las Vegas. But my feeling that I came away from the show was is there is so much going on in networking, in cloud, in the data center, in the IT organization itself inside a business that people are really hungry for new ideas. They have so many questions about where things are going. They have concerns about their job, their skill set. So there's so much to talk about. So it's an exciting time to be able to run a show like Interop because there's so many interesting conversations we can have.
There's no shortage of things to talk about.
Like no.
Five years ago, we would have stood up and had a series of presentations on spanning tree.
Right. And why everyone hates it.
Yeah, you know, or OSPF and, you know, how MPLS works or something in the tectorial track. You know, it's like, but today we're talking about what is the software-defined WAN and, you know, I was talking, I've been working with an SDN company just recently and they're laying out their strategy for SDN in the campus.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same technology applied. So in the same way that, you know, the campus network and the WAN network and the data center network are three different types of networks and three actually physically separate networks, the future of SDN and software defined and all that sort of hoo-ha is going to be the same. You know, there are different applications of the same technology in campus and WAN and data center. And it's wireless is coming and, you know, and then once you software define it, it can be integrated with other stuffs. So
Yeah, it's true. And it's not just the network. We've got a lot of discussion around OpenStack and how that's going to fit in a cloud slash hybrid cloud strategy. We've got containers coming up in the cloud area. We've got still BYOD and MDM and wrestling with mobility challenges, still a hot issue. And of course, good old security and storage. So even storage itself is being, so much new stuff is coming in. Not just we've got software-defined storage, we've got SSDs, we've got whole new ways to build and scale out arrays, distributed storage. Yeah,
and you've got 37 startups.
Right, there's so much activity going on in the market that there's so much good discussion going on. And besides, you know, IT also wrestling with its role in the business. You know, what happens when your internal users are going out to software as a service or outside services that you aren't providing? What does that mean for IT? How does IT become relevant in the organization? How do they get a seat at the table? So much good stuff to talk about.
Yeah. Just speaking of containers, that's a whole – the networking in the container space is that is a particularly challenging environment. If you've ever done some investigation into – so containers is Docker and CoreOS and things like this, all the latest buzzword stuff.
Yes.
But networking with containers is a major, major problem because the way that Docker works today is you can spin up 1,000 Docker instances in less than 5 seconds, but they're all connected to a single VLAN.
Ooh.
Right? That's how
it
is.
Sounds like a problem.
Yeah. Well, it's not a problem because it works. It's just not very secure and it doesn't allow any isolation. And in a cloud, it's kind of blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of, and there are moves afoot to start adding overlay networking to Docker instances. But today, Docker networking is just a bridge to the physical interface, and that's it. They use the Linux bridge and just connect it to the physical interface. So you're pretty limited to what you can do with it, right?
Right.
So there are SDN solutions coming for containers, Docker and so forth. And that's going to be, I think, a whole new networking thing, because if you think about, if you've got Docker instances were being spawned at 5-second intervals, and let's say you spawn hundreds of them a minute, are you going to attach them to your NSX overlay or your Cisco ACI overlay? And if you do, where are you going to use Open vSwitch, or are you going to use some other proprietary? But containers don't, the software, the container software may not allow those drivers to be used in a mode that containers can use, because they use the type of virtualization technology they use is doesn't necessarily work with the existing Open vSwitch stuff. So lots of good fun.
More to do.
More to do. Well, this is why VMware loves containers today, is because you can put containers in a VM and then put the VM in the isolation zone that you want. Which is silly, because now you're adding virtualization to a virtualization technology, so you can have some virtualization.
Wow, we are down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Well, no, it's all networking, right? These are the things that it was only when I was talking to people in the speakers room about Docker that I started to express these ideas. You know, I was talking to the people in the DevOps track, and they were going, yeah, yeah, these are real problems. But they're infrastructure problems as much as they're DevOps problems.
And it's, we've also got some news to talk about today besides interop, although I could go on all day about interop. Some news. First up is Brocade had an announcement about their Viata controller.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is open and daylight.
Just to set the stage, Viata was a company that was essentially building an open source router, and then Brocade came along and acquired them.
Yes, a couple of years ago, in fact.
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
And it's been incubating it, kept on developing it. There's now, they've released multiple versions of the Viata router. Interesting thing about Viata is that they've got the V5400 and the V5600. They're both software, but one's got a completely different software architecture, and they sell the new software architecture at a bigger price than the old architecture.
That's why people make new things.
Yeah. There's sort of like a mental leap that you have to make to say the new software is more expensive than the old software because it's faster.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to pay more for that. And you're kind of looking at it going, it's just Microsoft Word. you know, it's like a, I don't know. Maybe I'm being, you know, but this consumption-based pricing is not something that we've had in networking. So this idea that, you know, if this thing goes faster than the old thing, you should pay more for it still still baffles me, because I don't do that with cars or...
Well, I mean, I know it's software, but I think the networking industry is used to paying for more bandwidth or throughput. So maybe that's their reasoning.
Well, the thing is, though, if you buy a router, let's say you go and buy a Viata and then you pay for maintenance on it, shouldn't you get the updates? And this is the same for Microsoft Word and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
Is it really valuable? If you're buying Microsoft Word today, let's just take Microsoft Word, and you've paid $300 to get the initial copy, shouldn't you then get, if you're paying $100 a year every thereafter, shouldn't you expect to get the new version every 3 years because you've paid for it again?
Yes, I would expect that.
But today you have to go and repay a license fee. That doesn't seem... It just seems like you're being gouged.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
No. I think it's just hard for me to come at that. And Cisco's trying to do the same thing. So Cisco recently announced the ISR 4000 router, which is fundamentally an x86 box with iOS on it. It's got a bunch of really funky things in it. It's a good box, but it starts off at very low performance levels, and then you keep buying licenses as it goes faster and faster. It's not that the box got any more expensive. It's just you're paying to consume.
Right.
Which seems bizarre to me, because, you know, for the last 20 years, we've been buying routers based on maximum capacity, and you just let them go. You didn't have to keep going back to the well and getting another bucket of water every time you need it. Anyway, maybe I just need to adapt to the new thing.
I think it's the new thing. Can also just not pay for it, or look for somebody else.
That's probably more viable for a lot of people. So coming back to Brocade Viata controller, it is a rebadged Open Daylight, which is the most exciting thing. So as you know, I've been very positive about Open Daylight as a long-term success story.
And Open Daylight is a sort of open consortium to build an SDN controller and lots of other neat goodies around it.
Yes, so it's an open source OpenFlow controller. Well, it's not just an open, it's a network controller, and it'll support a wide range of protocols: OpenFlow, PCP, Lisp, a whole bunch of them. And the second version, Helium, was just released a week or two back, and at the same time, Brocade announced that they are going to be commercially packaging Open Daylight.
And yes,
this is, of course, on the back of their significant investment. I think they've built a like a rock star team over there of hiring SDN like significant figures in the networking industry who are coders and developers and strategists and so forth, and then putting them into place, like, you know, David Meyer, Kurt Beckman, Tom Nadal, you know, Colin Dixon, those types of people who really move the needle on the whole networking debate. And they all work for Brocade on this open, the Viata controller. So what they, the pitch that was given to me was that Brocade will be, as soon as the new version or new features are added to the code, Brocade will then package and slipstream them directly into their version as quickly as possible. So, and they'll provide commercial support, additional testing and packaging validation to make sure it's up to a certain level, and then take it to market. And you can buy it today, a commercially supported Open Daylight controller. I think they're the first one.
I'm trying to, I feel like, yeah, they could be the first one.
The first one.
I know HP was doing something with Open Daylight, but it may have been a link into their own OpenStack distro.
Well, Cisco, you used to have the XRC product, which was, or was it XNC? Which was their version, extensible network controller. But I don't think, and I could be wrong, and I'll apologize if I'm wrong in advance, that it was ever actually made it onto the sales list, like it ever made it onto the price list. And the idea was is that it would be a version of Open Daylight that was commercially supported by Cisco, but it only works with their Nexus 3000 switches using OpenFlow. And so I'm not sure that I want to cut off, it could be first, but I'm not sure it was ever actually sold. It was sort of announced.
Yes. I mean, I guess we've also got the Open Daylight Consortium itself rolling out Helium.
Anybody can go to the website.
Anybody can go and get it. Go grab it.
But then you're on your own, which is a good thing, right? It might be cheaper for you to hire a couple of headcount than it would be to pay for a licensing fee.
Yeah, possible. Certainly worth going and downloading and playing with. Maybe you can test drive before you decide to go to a more commercially supported version.
So Brocade's got a significant edge here because you can now buy Open Daylight on, start buying Open Brocade hardware to get that nice comfy feeling around your bottom region, because everybody wants to feel safe and secure, apparently. Nobody actually wants to sort of like take any risks, apparently, with their infrastructure, despite the fact that everybody's equipment doesn't work and it's full of bugs and we take risks with it even when we spend millions on it. But other than that...
Well, there's known risks and unknown risks.
Yes, perhaps. So that's good for their business because they've now got a strategy where, and from customers' point of view, this means that if you fell out of love with Brocade for some reason, you could then go and buy Red Hat's Open Daylight and replace it and have a very consistent experience.
Conceivably, yes.
Conceivably. Or you could go and buy somebody else's. So Extreme's announced that they're going to rebadge Open Daylight, and a number of other companies are heading in that direction. And I think that a lot of them will be looking at Brocade to see if this is successful. And
I Open Daylight is an interesting beast because it's also it's got projects in the works to sort of provide a standard set of northbound APIs for third parties to link into the controller. It's got a policy-based routing or a policy-based routing and switching effort in the works. So lots of neat stuff going on.
Well, yes, it's complementary to their Viata product. So the software router has a number of things coming up in the pipe where they're going to take that product in different... I'm not sure what I'm allowed to talk about. I can't remember what's under non-disclosure. So I'm going to say very little. it's not clear in my mind quite, so I'll say nothing. But it is very interesting because that it will be especially able to control the Viata product, which is going to do some interesting things in the near future. So worth paying attention to because it's actually innovation. It's true innovation. It's not I don't always see Cisco as being innovative here. I see the ACI as sort of taking their legacy hardware and legacy operating system, NXOS, and then putting something on top of it that sort of does the minimum amount of work to maximize the hardware. And conceptually, they're trying to sell more of their old hardware than they are shift you to a new way of working. That's it's a little unkind because ACI does do a lot of stuff in software, but right now it's very focused on selling you more hardware and less on giving you new services. It's about emulating VLANs, emulating routing, emulating some access lists, and that's about it. Whereas Open Daylight really turns this over and says, well, you can have anybody's hardware, but we're going to commercially support the controller, and we've got software routers, and we've got software firewalls, and we've got all this stuff that's just not coming out of Cisco. So it is different in that way. It's genuinely different.
Yes, it is. Although, and we should also mention that Cisco is, I think, one of the founding members of Open Daylight and certainly a major contributor.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the thing I like about Open Daylight is I can change it. So if Cisco ACI was built on Open Daylight, I'd be much more happy about that, because then I could always be using open standards or using something that's approaching an open standard, and I could change horses if I had to.
If you had to, yes.
And that's risk management there. If you go down a path of buying Cisco ACI today, you betting all your company's business on Cisco products, and that's a risk. You can't migrate away over time. You're committing down that path. Today, that's the way it is. Cisco's hoping, or said that they will, open source ACI, and it's blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's the way it is today. Everybody will potentially converge on open standards as long as customers ask for it and demand it.
Yes, that's the trick.
And that's the most important part is, you know, get in there and tell your vendors, if you ever get the chance, it's got to be open. It's got to be, you know, something.
Yes, and they have to prove it. They can't just say it.
Yeah, beat them up. At least just ask for now, yeah.
Right. we've also got some stuff to talk about around HP. They had some interesting news both at Interop and subsequently. An SDN app store coming out of HP at Interop.
Yeah, so this is the interesting one where, was it last year they announced the app store that they were
going
to do this?
They did. Yeah, I think it was last year.
And it was at New York, if I remember rightly. And everybody sort of was a little perplexed and didn't really know how that was going to work, but it was an innovative idea. It was, you know, HP was genuinely doing something different. This idea that you go and buy their VAN controller, you put it on the network, and over here's an app store, and you buy a license. You can click and download it onto your VAN controller, and you buy a license for it. You buy it through a reseller or wherever, and away you go. You've got the app. You don't have to go and, you know, if you want to, I think they're shipping three or four apps for the app store. No, eight, is it?
I think it's like 8 or 9, yeah. It's a decent number to go out of the gate with.
Yes, and so instead of going and approaching each one of the 8 or 9, you can just go directly to HP, click a button, and then install the app, and you're away you go.
Yes.
Now, that's really attractive because your installation cost just went much further down. You go straight from installation to using it.
Yes. Yeah, without a lot of cobbling together of your own APIs or making other connections.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it is, in fact, an innovative idea, and I think it's an indication of how disruptive SDN has become, that it's prompting, let's say, traditional companies to really try new things, and Brocade with Viata and the Open Daylight initiative is another example of that as well, vendors are trying to say, do things to differentiate themselves from the pack in really interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, the App Store idea initially didn't kind of make sense to me, but if you've already got the HP VAN controller, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like the Apple iPhone, right? There are things,
sure.
Like, I've got my new Apple iPhone. I haven't got a new one, but I've got my Apple iPhone. But using it is a really personal experience. In that, as I go around and use apps and all the things that are on my phone, they're my things. They're not my old Nokia 6110. Although I do miss my 6110 because it was tiny and it was light and the battery would last about a week. But I think the App Store is one of those things that it's not something that makes sense if you're looking at it from the outside, because normally you're thinking of it like, I've got to go to the vendor and buy this, I'll get this from my reseller, and if I want this other thing, I then go and talk to that company and then get a reseller to sell me that, and then I install it. And this App Store idea is one of these things that makes a lot more sense, where if you've already got a HP VAN controller and you can just click a button and install the extra app, then sales are a lot easier. The resistance to getting going with that is much less.
That's right.
And if you're coming at it from an outsider point of view, you sort of go, why would I want an app store? I've never seen one of these. That doesn't make any sense. I'm never going to buy something from an app store. But then you think about, if you've got that thing in your network and it's already been there for a year or two and you've been using it, then now you just go and buy, and you go, why? This is the obvious way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's interesting stuff.
And it's gated, so these other companies have to make sure their product meets certain standards and your updates are all blah blah blah.
Well, I think they've got three tiers. There's sort of a vetted tier where HP has partnered with a company specifically, and HP stands behind the application. And then they've got sort of underneath that is more of a HP says, okay, we've looked at this a little bit and we think it's going to be fine. And then they have a community tier where folks can just put some experimental stuff up there, and you can play around with it and maybe take on some more risk in terms of support and operations, but a model that allows them some flexibility so they can curate some and then do a little bit more experimenting.
Yeah, and that sort of allows both best of both models.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you look at the Android store and I think, why do I have to wait for Apple to approve everything? And,
Yes.
There are times when...
Yeah, you want to experiment. And I think it's also helpful because it gives developers a place to say, okay, if I am going to invest in this, I know I might get some return. Makes it a little bit more attractive to snap up some of that limited developer resources from their partner companies.
Yes, very much so.
The other HP news, HP took a cleaver to itself.
Yes, well... Everybody knows that a few years ago, well, everybody who was sort of around, was that there was a CEO of HP. HP's had a mixed bag of them, but one of them decided that he would sell off the desktop divisions, and everybody shook their head and tut-tutted and or went into epileptic fits and said HP without desktops would be not a business at all. Turns out that HP really needed to get rid of it. And then sort of like a year later, IBM sold off its PCs and then its servers, and now it's a different company, apparently. So HP's going to follow that path. The logic, I believe, goes something like printers makes a mozza out of ink and is a hugely profitable business.
Yes.
But it's not growing because people are stopping printing to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Because people have mobile phones, why would you print something, I guess? And the desktops business is such low margin that it's not worth being in. Like, Hewlett-Packard and IBM are companies that run on very large profit margins, and neither of those businesses are growing. They're static. The profit, those businesses aren't good for share price, so they should hive it off into like a life insurance fund.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? There's life insurance funds with a growing, and then at some point they decide that they need to stop selling more, and it
yes.
moves into like a maintenance mode, and it goes to a company. There are specialist life insurance companies who manage pension funds and for the minimum possible cost and just rake the profits off.
Yes.
And that's what this will be. I think the printers and the desktops will go over here, and its share price will be static and blah, blah, blah. So shift it over there. And then over here is HP Enterprise, which is the growth engine, which will do cloud and all the other stuff, storage and servers and so forth.
And services and all that.
Yes. So. Yes, it's just a financial thing, I think, don't you?
Sure. I mean, Meg Whitman was talking about flexibility and agility, that HP Enterprise will be able to be more agile now. And I think there's probably something to that if they're not trying to put some effort into eking out a tiny bit more margin out of PCs and such. What's amazing to me is one, that you can cut the company in half and both pieces will still be in the Fortune 50. I think that's amazing. But also the sentiment that even though you've got a Fortune 50 company, there's still some concern about the viability going forward of what HP Enterprise is going to be.
You think?
I do. I think they're, based on what I've been reading, it seems like there's some sense that HP is still wobbling a bit. They're a giant corporation, a giant brand, but the sentiment that I feel like I'm picking up is that we'll see what happens here.
Well, it's true. I mean, they're stuck with a lot of legacy products, a bit like IBM stuck with a lot of you know, it's still got the PowerPC stuff, and it's still got the mainframes, and it's still got the, you know, are they actually lead generation businesses that keep customers locked in? And, you know, they might not be hugely profitable, but they're profitable enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they're part of a portfolio of customer, you know, customer relations that actually keep customers locked in.
Yep. Yeah. But also to that point, talking about agility or innovation, I think HP is also, you know, putting some of its money where its mouth is through efforts like the App Store. They're trying something new and different.
Well, they got the Moonshot servers, which is
yes, they got the Moonshot servers. Yeah,
which is somebody did something different for a change.
Yeah, there are those low power, tiny ARM servers that you can cobble together for lots of interesting applications.
Yeah. And they've done a bunch of stuff. They've been a little slow to the converged market,
mm-hmm.
Which might be more of a testimony to HP's internal infrastructure than anything else.
Right.
Because, you know, the internally to HP, it's often legendarily fiefdoms more than cooperative business units.
Mm-hmm.
Cisco has the same problem too.
Right.
You know, so it's not a new thing. It's a lot of the business. There was a business model for the last decade, or last 20 years, of if you're a really, really big company and you want to dominate a market, set up lots of business units and then let them compete with each other. And that way the whole company does well, because then the customer gets the best product from each business unit because they're all fighting against each other. And it mm-hmm. prevents startups from coming in to the market,
mm-hmm.
except that doesn't work anymore.
Right.
That only worked, that would, you know, I would suggest that that only worked when you had a lock on certain technology. So, for example, the silicon moat. If you were making a storage array or a router or a switch, you needed a couple of $100 million spent over 3 years to make a silicon chip and the software operating system and to package it up, and then you needed a sales force to take it to market, right?
Right.
And so only big companies could do that. So the way you made sure that you had lots of products coming to market, and then the competitive ecosystem would wither the ones that didn't sell, and the ones that win, what customer would choose, and, you know, a few customers would be left with the FUD, with the dud. We've all been caught with them, right?
Uh-huh.
But overall, the big company survives. But I think we're seeing a generational change here where startups can get silicon very cheaply for various reasons. Like, it's easy now to buy a software package that can design a silicon chip. So a startup with 50 people only takes 18 months to design a chip because they have the software to make the chip design. The people with the expert skills are leaving the big companies as the big companies struggle to stay profitable. They set up a startup, and then they just send the chip off to Taiwan to make the chip.
Right.
Right. We talked about that last week, like Expliant
mm-hmm.
Was bought for $90 million. Funding, I think it was about $25 million. And they built a switch chip that's significantly ahead of the competition. Like, Cisco's doing one of these chips like the XPliant, which has this flexible packet pipeline, but only in the products that sell for more than $500,000 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And Cavium's going to release this in a much smaller package down around the cheaper price bracket. So,
yeah, I do think there's something to that model. And when you have a large institution, you inevitably get, you know, drag on business processes and innovation. So sometimes smaller can actually be a little more nimble.
I think it's, you know, I've said this before. I think the next 10 years of technology, of IT, is defined by technology leadership, not management expertise or sales capability or warehousing capabilities or, you know, financial resources. Those things matter less in the next 10 years than having strong technology capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Customers expect to buy the best technology now, and whereas the last 20 years has been dominated by, you know, salespeople on the ground, funding to be able to make salespeople and get them into places where they need, you know, making big deals and signing 10-year support contracts. I think that'll matter less in the years ahead than it did. They have less inherent value, and the rise of technology is customers are going to say, "I need a technology proposition, not a." I want to do business with a tried, trusted, boring company.
It's possible. Although I think humans being who they are, there'll always be a role for the tried, trusted.
Oh, yeah, no, there is. What I'm saying is there's a trend too. Right?
Yes.
So, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% of the market starts to evaluate technology as a leading factor, not I'm going to buy it from the big vendor who I've always thrown lots of money at for the last decade.
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to do that. But if that trend, you know, even if 20% of the market shifts in that direction, that changes the shape of the market enormously.
Yes, it does.
Because then the big, as soon as 20%, 5 or 10% go, the big companies have to start innovating too. They're forced to, or they lose their growth, and then they lose their share price value. If there's no growth, there's no share price.
Right.
Their shares will be devalued by a significant amount. 30% usually is the growth factor.
And that's when we start to see the acquisitions.
Or the splits.
Or the splits. Speaking of which,
yes.
HP is not the only one to split. Just got word that Symantec is going to split its operations.
Stop my beating heart.
So I guess the company is going to have a security company and a storage company.
Information management, they call that.
Information management.
Who knows?
Yes.
Backup? Is that the backup piece? Probably.
Probably yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's basically two things in there. One is the Norton stuff.
Yeah.
And the other one is the net backup. There is, of course, a whole bunch of other stuff in their portfolio. They have many, many products, but they're the two popular products that everybody knows a lot about.
Right.
And it does make sense to diversify. I mean, Symantec was one of those companies that needed to grow as the antivirus business started to shrink, as it became less effective, and they bought the backup product.
They bought Veritas, yeah.
And a bunch of other things in the space. They've got lots and lots of products. So it does make sense to break Symantec back down into its... You know, it's the fashion. Every 10 years, we try to make big companies, and then they turn around and go back the other way.
Right. I think the logic back then was that, I mean, for one, the antivirus growth market was slowing, but there was also the logic was, well, storage and security are interrelated. You've got to protect the data that you have, and we can bring you economies of scale, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe it made sense back then, and now we'll see what happens.
I think it sort of proves that software doesn't scale. I think software comes best from small companies.
You think?
Yeah, I'm coming. I think now, in the current phase of the market, this is... Once upon a time, you needed a big company to develop a software product because it was very difficult to test and to, you know, build platforms and blah, blah, blah. Whereas today, software itself makes more software. So you have free software solutions like Jenkins and Garrett and Maven are able to do automated continuous integration testing, where once you needed a whole team of people, you know, sometimes for big companies, hundreds and thousands of people doing testing and integration, validation, all that sort of stuff. That's now done automatically. And you can actually, and as you look at these startups like Facebook and Instagram and Pinterest who've come up in the last 5 years, those companies prove that you can do an awful lot of software with just a few headcount.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the shift to software means the staffing and some of the rules by which these big companies operated are breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense.
It does make sense.
Of course, there won't be any less software in the world.
No. Nothing ever goes away.
No. I don't believe that there'll be less value, less money spent. It'll just be spent on other stuffs.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not too interested in that because there's not much networking there. People who do storage or security might care, but I don't. But
then let us move on.
I think it does herald. Of course, there's been lots of chatter this week about EMC Federation. So EMC has four business units, theoretically RSA, Pivotal, VMware, and the EMC Classic, as they now call it. And it's sort of if these bigger companies, then they are obviously much bigger than EMC. Are splitting up, then so should EMC. And indeed, there's been an activist investor that's been trying to kick them in the pants and split them up. So Elliott Investment, who isn't what they call an activist investor,
yes,
has published a letter and said, we need to defederate and throw it in, turn it into little tiny pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And there's good story. There's a good, I believe that's important.
So what would be the benefit for breaking up EMC?
What's the benefit for keeping it federated except for somebody's ego at the top of the company? That's all I see. I mean, you're talking about a storage company and a virtualization company and a
security company
and a PaaS company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they all have tie-ups, but it is possible to integrate them, but how many companies want to buy all of those products? And if they don't want to buy those products and want to buy one of the three, what happens to the Federation? How much value does it bring?
Sure, that's true.
I mean, how much integration is there between RSA and VMware today?
Yeah, not very much.
Well, there's a lot between Pivotal and VMware.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to deploy the Pivotal Cloud Foundry and then deploy a PLAS platform on VMware, there's some good integration, but that was because they sort of got together 5 or 6 years ago. You don't need a federation to make that happen.
Right.
That would happen anyway. And EMC storage is sort of regarded as a low-growth business. Most people don't think that, you know, EMC has kind of like got high profit margins and locked in customers, but the activists, the storage startups are sort of eating away at its growth. So
yeah.
Where's EMC's value? You know, are they able to make the transition away to lower cost, lower profit margin businesses to compete against the startups, or is it just going to slowly shrink as people gradually turn away to the competitors?
Yeah, but I think it's going to be a significant fight before EMC would ever let go of VMware.
Yeah. I don't think they've got a choice, to be honest. I think the pressure to, you know, VMware needs to be independent of EMC.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of, like, HP is going to, I mean, a lot of the reason that OpenStack is getting legs is because it's not VMware.
Right.
And it's not EMC. So HP's got a storage portfolio. They don't want to sell VMware, which ties in tightly with EMC's storage. So therefore, OpenStack gets a lot of investment. Cisco's
mm-hmm.
doing the same thing. They're supporting OpenStack as a competitive play against VMware
mm-hmm.
because then they don't have to do business with EMC. If that momentum continues, then EMC will lose all of its business partners.
Mm-hmm.
And VMware shrinks in value because it's not in an open competitive space where it can be independent of...
Right.
So I think it's probably inevitable. Might not happen this year. I agree with you. It might not happen this year because Joe Tucci's probably got a firm grip on the board and the company itself. But right. Like HP desktops, maybe not this year, but we'll get you in next year, something like that.
Well, we'll stay tuned and track that and see if more activist investors emerge.
It'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what it's the decision will be made on Wall Street. It won't be made.
Yeah. I think you're right about this.
Yeah. I believe the share price was up 3% yesterday on the back of speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody, which means that everybody believes that this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are buying the shares expecting the split up to determine to would provide more value in the long run.
Right.
So if the share price continues to run up steeply, then most people believe that this is a done thing and it'll happen. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll keep our eye on it.
Maybe.
And last but not least, some news on 200 gig standards.
Oh, yes. So I talked last week about the two emerging 100 gig standards, 100 gigabase CLR4 and the CWDM4. And I just wanted to say some of the things I said last week may have been incorrect. I'm still waiting to be briefed, but I will let you know more in the week ahead, in the next week or two, once I know exactly what the difference is.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to flag that up front before we get there.
Okay.
Yeah. Just one last thing. What do you think about Cisco? If EMC is going to be broken up into pieces, could you break Cisco up?
I think you'd have a harder time breaking up mm-hmm. Cisco. I mean, I could see, you know, let's carve out a security business or let's mm-hmm. carve out, you know, away from the networking business. But to me, Cisco's acquisitions generally seem in line with the company as opposed to being sort of an odd amalgamation like EMC.
Okay, let me have a go at it then.
Go ahead.
Take all the video stuff and get rid of that rubbish. Take the Tanberg stuff, the service provider, the NDS acquisition, the set-top boxes, and put all that in a separate company and say video is out there. Get rid of that rubbish.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Get rid of all the social media assets they bought. They bought a bunch of social media assets when that was fun in the mid-2000s.
Yes.
Do you remember all those? Jive and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, I do remember, yes.
Yes, and they need to get rid of that rubbish. Just get back, like, to, you know, and throw out some of the non-performing. They've got plenty of product overlap. Is it really necessary to have that many products?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said, these business units all compete with each other. If you accept that argument, then why is it necessary to have 9 switch families?
Right.
Maybe we could have a few less products and a little more focus to generate a little more profit, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I could see maybe shaving off a smaller business unit here or there, but that to me is different from what's happening with HP and Symantec, and who knows about EMC. Because Cisco's done that in the past, where like they bought flip video cameras and then got rid of it fairly quickly. I could maybe see them jettisoning set-top boxes and stuff, but that's not splitting up a company. That's just saying, we actually made a mistake here.
They're big businesses. That's if you take Tandberg and NDS, that's a $10 billion chunk.
You think?
Oh, no, it is. Yeah, they paid $5 billion for NDS and $7 billion for Tandberg.
Mm-hmm.
So I would figure those businesses would have shrunk a bit because video hasn't been a huge success.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe it's a $10 billion chunk to spit out the other side.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just feel like there's still I can connect the dots easier for Cisco owning a video business than I can for EMC owning a virtualization company.
Well, my point is that video is not over the top. All of Cisco's video businesses are in the network. So the video conferencing is in the network. It's meant to be a device in the network. And NDS is for carriers to do streaming video over their networks.
Uh-huh.
So if you're a Comcast or, you know, Brazilian Telecom and that sort of stuff, you buy NDS to stream TV over your cable network or for whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
In network, not out of network. Mm-hmm. What we know is that I would think that most people would just look at that and go, you mean not Netflix? And it's like, no, not Netflix. Not over the internet, not over the top. So
yeah.
It's kind of like, okay, you know, good, once again, good closed businesses with solid profit generation. You know, if you're selling Cisco, you know, internet backbones, you can plug this on top and get some synergy. But at the end of the day, not growth businesses, they're dead end businesses, buggy whips.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, doing video in the network is a bit pointless. Where you want to be is actually selling Apple iPhones that have video conferencing in them. If you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yes. So that's why I would make my argument that the video stuff is the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, take all of the other rubbish that's in there, like all these little tiny business units, and get rid of them too.
Uh-huh. A little spring cleaning in the tech industry.
All right.
All right. I think we've come to the end of another engaging network break.
Well, we should stop making stuff up and actually go and do some real work, I should imagine.
But it's so much fun to make stuff up.
I know. It's like, you know, have an opinion.
That's so much easier.
Share it with the world and then be wrong and we'll get it right next week.
That's right.
Maybe.
You can always correct it next week.
That's it.
Or at least change the opinion.
Well, it's a goal.
That's a goal.
Yeah.
So where can folks find you all this week?
This week I'll be hanging out at home wearing my virtual underpants.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. What I actually mean is warm, you know, nice, comfortable clothes with trows with an elasticated waist. They won't be actual underpants, they're virtual underpants. Writing and researching and generally making comments on Twitter as @etherealmind. And I've also just started a challenge to myself to blog 30 times in 30 days. So I'm going to be doing that on my blog at etherealmind.com. Come along. And I'm also challenging you to do the same. So those of you who have a blog, maybe you could challenge yourself to blog 30 times in the next 30 days and tell me and share stuff with the community and really, really promote getting away from the social media networks that want to lock you into a particular viewpoint or to exploit you. What I would like to see is if everybody got a blog and just started sharing some ideas or, you know, a paragraph or two about something that happened the other day, the world would be a richer, more enjoyable place. Join me.
All right, there you go. The 30-day manifesto from Greg.
Well, I stole the idea from Matt at WordPress.com. He, one of his friends challenged him. And then Om Malik, who's a well-known writer, said he's going to go with this as well. And I was really inspired by that. And when I actually sat down and thought about it, I thought, you know, I'm just going to do it too. And then just to add a little soupçon of community to that, I thought I'd invite everybody to join.
Fantastic. In. Well, at the very least, we can try to keep you honest and check in.
Mm.
Fantastic. I am not going to take the 30-day blogging challenge, at least not this month. But you can still find me on Twitter at @interop_Andrew. And I will be posting to the Interop page on informationweek.com. And of course, we will be back, Greg and I, again, to talk into your head, hopefully next week.